The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 2nd of June 2020 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Allianz.
As part of the programme's partnership with Allianz, we are bringing you stories that demonstrate Allianz's commitment to securing people's lives. After all, for 130 years all around the globe, Allianz has been working hard to do just that, to give courage to its customers for what's ahead. Because Allianz knows how important it is to have a fair partner at your side who provides solid and sustainable solutions. Allianz strives to do it right, with passion, every day. Stay tuned to The Briefing to hear exactly how Allianz does it. An Allianz for life.
Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up,
I've been quite emotional at those locations and seeing what I've been seeing. And not so much because of the loss of property, which is certainly significant, but the expression of that and what that symbolizes of the deep pain that our communities are experiencing right now.
Protests continue across the United States. How much momentum do they now have? And is the response of the president helping, hindering, or having actually not much to do with it? Here in the UK, Parliament returns, or does it? We'll look at why some MPs are determined to refill the benches. We'll hear from Dr. Chris Smith about contradicting claims of how COVID-19 may be mutating, and later in the show.
I'm Monocle's design editor, Nolan Giles, and I'll be talking about how Singapore's clean green image is getting a little wilder.
That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. The United States is braced for another strange and difficult day. Protests across the country, sparked in the first instance by outrage at the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police on May 25th, have escalated, as has the response of law enforcement, though it is an open question which escalation is driving which. US President Donald Trump, before and after staging an inexplicable photo op waving a Bible around on a street recently cleared at Truncheon Point, has brought his famous knack for empathy and conciliation to bear, threatening to deploy America's military against American citizens. First of all, this is Minneapolis's director of the Division of Race and Equity, Joy Marsh Stevens, speaking earlier.
When I think about the scenes in Minneapolis, as I travel through the city, both on the south side, which is where George Floyd was murdered, and on the north side, where I've spent a significant amount of time this past weekend connecting residents to resources, what I see is a lot of damage to properties that have been a part of my life for most of my life. And that is shocking. I've been led to tears. I've been quite emotional at those locations and seeing what I've been seeing. And not so much because of the loss of property, which is certainly significant, but the expression of that and what that symbolizes of the deep pain that our communities are experiencing right now and the centuries of struggle between particularly the Black community and policing as an institution and seeing that on full display, just the deep pain of that and the trauma around that. That's what I'm seeing, and that's deeply shocking.
That was Joy Marsh Stevens. I'm joined now with more on this by Deborah Archer, professor at NYU School of Law and co-faculty director of the Center on Race, Inequality and the Law. And Deborah, first of all, what are you expecting in New York City today? It's just after 7 in the morning where you are now.
Well, good morning, Andrew. Thank you for having me here. I think we're expecting in New York City more of what we've seen, and that is powerful, peaceful protests where people are demanding recognition of their humanity and their equality. And of course, I think that we'll still see people who are coming into the communities in New York City trying to stoke violence and to advance their own agenda, which has nothing to do with why folks are in the streets calling for justice. And so I think we'll see more of that today.
Well, let's take a closer look at the majority of those peaceful protesters. It's not just New York, of course. This is now happening in dozens of cities across the United States and indeed the world. But if we look at just the US, is it your sense that these are all now protests being driven by the same thing, or is it more local concerns? So, for example, in New York, is it a specifically New York focus the demonstrations are starting to take?
I think we have to separate the protests from the looters and the violence. And so for the protests, I believe the protests in New York City are fighting for the same thing that they're fighting for around the country. They're asking for people to recognize the fundamental humanity and dignity of Black people. They're asking for people to stop conflating brown skin with dangerousness and criminality and inhumanity. And they're asking for the end to the weaponization of law enforcement against people of color. And so I think that that's true in every city around the United States where people are engaged in peaceful protests. They're asking for the same thing, because we see that problem in every city around the country where police are using excessive violence against Black and brown communities.
I just want to pick up that phrase of yours, the weaponization of law enforcement. To what extent do you think in the United States that has been a factor in the repeated circumstances of brutality towards Black people in particular? It's this extraordinary specter of police appearing on the streets wearing more equipment and carrying more ammunition and riding in bigger armored vehicles than most countries' militaries do.
That's absolutely right. And so what you raises two issues. With the weaponization of law enforcement, I think that's demonstrated in why white people across the country feel free to call the police on Black people who are just trying to live their lives, because they know that when the police come, they're going to support the claims of the white person and target the Black and brown folks. But the other issue you raised is around the militarization of the police force. And it's something, one of the systemic problems in this country that we need to address if we actually want to achieve reform. I think people are very focused, unfortunately, on just rooting out the bad apples in police departments around the country, and we absolutely have to do that. But we also have to challenge the underlying systemic issues that created the situation that led to the death of George Floyd and Freddie Gray and Michael Brown and Sean Bell and Tamir Rice. Those are systemic issues. The militarization of the police is one of those systemic issues.
A lot of the coverage of these protests overseas is, of course, focusing on the bizarre and mesmerizing figure of the President of the United States. When you're in the middle of these protests, where they're happening, indeed in Donald Trump's hometown, is it your sense that he is even a factor? Are these protests in any sense against him particularly, or is he perceived as a bit of an irrelevance at this point?
He is absolutely not irrelevant, I think. I don't think the protests are against him. The protests are against this violence, this humiliation, the degradation that Black and brown people experience every day. And he's one component of that. I think what he is doing is not showing leadership during this tragic time. I think he is only inflaming the situation. He's breathing oxygen on these fires. And so his engagement at this moment is not what anyone would have hoped from a United States president. He is not helping the situation. He's not supporting protesters who are peacefully calling for change. He's not helping to bring calm and order. He's not helping to bring any leadership in addressing the underlying systemic issues. So in the end, he's simply absolutely not helping. And I would also say that his the Department of Justice under his leadership has also not been helping address these underlying issues. They pulled back from their responsibility to police the police. And so a lot of what we are seeing now is also because the Department of Justice is not doing what it needs to do.
I mean, these are very far from the first large-scale protests sparked by mistreatment of black people in the United States. And people have been reaching back through history for points of comparison, whether it's Ferguson 2014, Los Angeles 92, the demonstrations following the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, Watts 1965. Mm-hmm. Do these strike you as being on that continuum, or are we looking at something new and completely different?
I hope we're looking at something new and completely different than some of those protests that you mentioned, because I'm hoping that we've gotten to a point where America recognizes the need for more than rhetoric, the need for more than supporting these protesters in words, but not actions. And so I'm hoping that this is different. It's certainly some of the things that you're seeing are different. We see police officers and law enforcement from around the country speaking out against what they saw in the videotape of George Floyd being killed. We have seen police officers marching with protesters, taking a knee with protesters. And we've seen police officers fired immediately for using excessive force in dealing with protesters. What I hope we see is that after all the protests are done, that folks will come together for real change. It has happened on occasions. The protests brought us the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Protests and uprisings brought us the Fair Housing Act as well. And so I'm hopeful that these protests and uprisings will bring real systemic reform to how the police engage and occupy black and brown communities.
Deborah Archer, thank you for joining us. That was Deborah Archer in New York City. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. It's inevitably tempting where the COVID-19 pandemic is concerned to fling oneself headlong upon the tiniest morsel of hope. Much excitement was therefore generated by claims of doctors in Italy, where COVID-19 struck early and hard, that the virus is weakening. This suggestion was almost immediately rubbished by experts elsewhere who have said that COVID-19 is not mutating in any helpfully diluted direction. Well, I'm joined now by Dr. Chris Smith, Monocle 24's health and science correspondent, also a virologist at Cambridge University. Chris, first of all, this claim made by the Italian doctors, what did they say and why might they have said it?
I'm slightly baffled by this. I wonder if it kind of got lost in translation a bit, because obviously countries which have had a peak are now beginning to recover. They're beginning to open up and return to some semblance of normality, not full normality, but some semblance of normality. And I wondered if what they were trying to get across was that the virus itself, its impact, its stranglehold on the community, its ability to sort of pierce our hearts is reduced a bit. And this has been sort of turned into the viruses in some way become much less malignant and it's fine, it's back to business as usual, because of course it's not. And the WHO have come out fighting straight away. Maria van Kerkhove, who's their technical lead for WHO health emergencies, said it hasn't changed in its severity, it hasn't changed in its transmissibility. In other words, you can still catch it and it can still spread equally well, and if you do catch it, you've still got the same likelihood you always had that it's going to make a certain proportion of people severely unwell.
Is there any likelihood or history of viruses just kind of burning themselves out?
Oh, yes. And this is actually par for the course. When you have a new virus that has its first foray into an entirely new host species, whether that's an animal giving us a new infection, which is actually where 75 to 80% of new outbreaks of virus infections come from, they are what's called zoonoses. Very often, because those viruses are not well adapted to their new host, they've evolved to, for instance, flourish in a bat. Then when they get into a human, it's, although another kind of mammal, it's a very different physiological and biochemical setup. And so the viruses are often tooled up in all the wrong directions. And this means they tend to have a much higher than normal pathogenicity rate. They're much more lethal. We've seen this with Ebola, for example. When Ebola jumps into a human from its natural host, which is a bat, it's about 50 to 75% lethal. With H5N1, the bird flu, it just makes some birds very unwell, but most birds will just have this, like we have human seasonal flu. If that jumps into a human, you end up with a 50% lethality rate. So when viruses first get into people, they very infrequently are so well adapted to us as this new coronavirus. This is an exceptional virus, this new coronavirus. It's really well adapted to humans. It doesn't have a high pathogenicity. It spreads very easily, and it's also relatively asymptomatic in a very high fraction of people, which is why it's such a headache to deal with.
So are we learning anything? And we have now been living with it for a few months. Are we learning anything about how COVID-19 specifically is mutating and adapting?
On the mutation front, which means how fast is this virus genetically altering? The answer to that question is quite well understood, and it's altering only very slowly. It's what we call antigenically very stable. People have been tracking the virus from the first forays into humans back in November in Wuhan right through to the present day. They've gathered hundreds of genomes where they've actually read the genetic information of the virus from people who've been infected at various points along the last 6 months and in various geographies. There's no evidence that it's changing very radically or very rapidly. It's only garnered a handful of genetic changes. Perhaps 15, 20 genetic changes since the very first forays into humans. And that's a very low mutation rate. If you contrast that with, for instance, a norovirus, the person who catches that, and that's a cause of diarrhea and vomiting, the virus is making hundreds of times more genetic changes in every cycle through a person than this new coronavirus. So in that respect, it is not changing very fast. In terms of what we're learning about it, we're learning a lot all the time. And what's emerged, the really kind of striking thing that's come to us, is that the virus isn't so much killing people because of a viral attack. It's the ensuing immune attack on our own bodies that's actually leading to a lot of the symptoms and consequences. And that's what now scientists and doctors are going after, trying to comprehend why this is happening and how we might be able to use the drugs we've got to tinker with the immune response to try to head off that tailspin that some people inevitably go into to minimize the devastating damage that happens to just a small number, but a significant number of people who catch it.
Well, just to go back to where we came in then, is there anything that the rest of the world can learn from the Italian experience? Obviously, Italy was one of the first countries struck in Europe, certainly, with a major attack of it. They went from 6,500 known new cases a day in late March to just 200 confirmed yesterday. Is there anything there that's exportable?
Well, all countries are sharing data like they never have before, sharing experiences and trying to work out the best way around these things, not least that people are looking to countries that are de-escalating from their lockdown to see how fast viruses come back, whether or not the social distancing measures that are in place are actually going to work. For example, some countries have got 1 meter, some countries have 1.5 meters. In Britain at the moment we're at 2 meters. People are talking about changing that. So there's a lot of data sharing going on. There's a lot of patient care information going on and a lot of collaborations scientifically between universities and other centres. We had a story in the Daily Telegraph on Sunday, for example. We're going to ship samples from Cambridge, where we've had more cases of coronavirus than the whole of Australia, to Australia, so that the Australian National Phenome Centre at Murdoch University in Perth can analyse those samples to see if we can find chemical fingerprints that are predictive of people having good or bad outcomes with coronavirus, so we can potentially develop a test to find out who's most at risk much earlier in their illness and then potentially intervene earlier with some of the drugs and other potentially disease-modifying treatments that we have.
Chris, thanks as always. That was our health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
As part of the program's partnership with Allianz, we are bringing you stories that demonstrate Allianz's commitment to securing people's lives. After all, Allianz has been working hard to do just that, to give courage to its customers for what's ahead. Because Allianz knows how important it is to have a fair partner at your side. Stay tuned to The Briefing to hear exactly how Allianz does it. An Allianz for life.
You're listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Here in the UK, the House of Commons will decide later today on the best means of permitting Parliament to continue its work in the present suboptimal circumstances. The government has declared itself unimpressed by virtual meetings and remote voting and so forth, and wants business to return to something like as usual. Several MPs have pointed out, not unreasonably, that this could potentially exclude them, and by extension their constituents, because they are self-isolating and or in a high-risk category for COVID-19 and or caring for someone else. I'm joined with more on this by Lance Price, former Director of Communications at No. 10 Downing Street. Lance, Parliament's been operating under bizarre hybrid arrangements since mid-April. How different have they been from what Parliament is usually like?
Oh, they've been completely different. I mean, the scenes that we always used to see of MPs crowded into the chamber of the House of Commons, because there aren't enough seats in the House of Commons for all the MPs deliberately. So it gives you that sense of a packed a chamber. All of that has changed. MPs aren't allowed to sit next to each other. We've seen more recently pictures of them sitting several metres apart. It's changed the whole tenor of Prime Minister's questions when we were used to sort of braying crowds behind the Prime Minister and behind the Leader of the Opposition. All of that's changed. And of course, we've been seeing MPs coming in remotely from their constituencies, sometimes with greater success than others, trying to contribute to debates and ask questions.
So why is the government in such a hurry to get Parliament to something like work? Because I guess there's two possible strands to pursue here. One is that it's just genuinely, straightforwardly strategic that they want Parliament to be able to function properly. But is there a cosmetic angle as well that they want to return, I guess, to the Punch and Judy theatre of PMQs in particular?
Yeah, there is definitely a cosmetic angle. I think two cosmetic angles, actually. The first is that the Prime Minister has been noticeably lackluster during Prime Minister's questions. And the new Labour leader, Sir Keir Starmer, has got the better of him in pretty much all of the exchanges. And Boris Johnson appears to be lost without a cheering crowd behind him. But that's not really going to change in the short term anyway, because the Speaker of the House of Commons has made it very clear he's not going to relax the rule about how MPs have to space themselves out. In fact, there's been a bit of a dressing down for MPs this morning for staying put in their seats and not getting up and leaving the chamber when they've asked a question so that other people can take their place. So that's not going to change so much. The other cosmetic reason is I think they want to show that the country is getting back to normal, that businesses are getting back to normal. And in that sense, House of Commons is a business. So it's a key element of Britain's public life. And they want to show normality, I suppose. But it's bitterly contested by a very large number of MPs. And there's going to be a bit of a ding-dong about it quite soon, I think, in the Commons.
Well, that number of MPs, do we know how very large it is? Is it, for example, large enough to defeat the government on this?
Well, the number of people who've expressed disquiet publicly isn't large enough to defeat the government, but I think they'll get a lot of support from others. And it's not just the elderly. I mean, anybody who is supposed to be self-isolated, whether they're elderly or pregnant or have health issues, diabetes, any of those things, there's all sorts of MPs who've protested about that. And the Equality and Human Rights Commission have weighed in this morning and said that it is discriminatory against them and by definition their constituents to exclude them from the proceedings of the House of Commons. But also a lot of MPs who have to travel very large distances, including the big block of Scottish MPs, who say it's absolutely ridiculous that they should travel and take risks by travelling in order to participate. So I think whether or not if it was put to a vote, the government would lose. I think the strength of opinion is sufficient that the government is going to have to backtrack in some form.
So just in normal circumstances, what are the consequences or disadvantages if an MP can't actually come to the Commons? What are they and therefore their constituents missing out on?
Well, they can't. I mean, if you don't have virtual participation, and it does look as if there'll be some continuation of some form of virtual participation, but if you can't have virtual participation, then if an MP can't come to the House of Commons, they can't speak up for their constituents, they can't take part in debates. And there's already been a little bit of a movement on that, so that women, for example, after giving birth, can now have a substitute ask on their behalf and take part in debates on their behalf. So there's there's a growing recognition that there has to be some understanding that MPs are human beings like everybody else, and if they can't get to their place of work, some accommodation has to be made for that.
Thinking, therefore, with your political strategist's hat on, does it strike you as weird that the government, having burned such an extraordinary amount of political capital in defending Dominic Cummings, is now going as hard on this, where, you know, a battle which they probably won't win in as complete a fashion as they'd prefer?
Yes, I think that's right. And I think privately, quite a few members of the cabinet are very uneasy about the whole thing. And to an extent, Jacob Rees-Mogg, the slightly extraordinary figure who's sometimes described as the member for the 18th century, who's the leader of the House of Commons, is out on his own on this. And I haven't seen a lot of support from other cabinet ministers for the position that he's insisted upon in demanding that MPs turn up and potentially have a sort of what's been described as the Jacob Rees-Mogg conga line, almost a kilometre long of socially distanced MPs trying to get through the division lobbies. I think he's going to have to backtrack and lose some face over this.
Lance Price, on that happy visual image of a conga line of Jacob Rees-Mogg's, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Japan might be one of the world's biggest economies, a global leader in everything from architecture to food, and a country whose brands have flourished around the world, but it remains a bit of a mystery. Published by Thames and Hudson, the Monocle Book of Japan is the culmination of years of reporting across the country by Monocle, and it delivers a unique insight into the people, places and products that define this extraordinary nation. Painting a portrait of the country from Hokkaido to subtropical Okinawa, you'll find in-depth coverage of culture, retail, hospitality, transport and more, as well as profiles of the people and pups who have helped shape Japan. The latest in our series of beautiful large format books, The Monocle Book of Japan, is available now. Find out more at monocle.com/shop.
You're listening to The Briefing, and finally on today's show, we're going to take a look at news from the world of design, and I'm joined to do that by Monocle's design editor, Nolan Giles. Nolan, you wanted to talk specifically about Singapore. There's been this worldwide phenomenon over recent months of, I guess, what we can think of as rewilding, as things come back to cities which had not seen them for quite some while. Now, there are a few more urban landscapes than Singapore. What's been happening there?
Yeah, I mean, there really are, you know, not many landscapes as urban as Singapore, but really there are also not so many cities that are as green as Singapore. And Singapore for years, I think since, you know, the days of Lee Kuan Yew, has really promoted this idea of the city being a garden city, and made great effort to, you know, have beautiful botanical gardens across the city. When a new building is raised, for example, all of the greenery that has gone has to be once again included on that building. You have to, if you're taking nature away, you have to bring it back into the city. But this all being said, Singaporeans like to keep things very neat with their gardening. So, you know, you have this green garden city, but it's a very well-maintained, impeccable, beautiful garden. And then obviously when everything has kicked off with the pandemic, the gardeners haven't been able to maintain it so well. So, like you say, we've seen this wildness within Singapore, which, you know, has brought a whole lot of new biodiversity and nature to the city. And actually, Singaporeans are really enjoying it, Andrew. They're loving what they're seeing, and they're interested now in, you know, how far they can go with this wilding, and it's really going to become, you know, talked about within policy there in terms of how the built environment moves forward.
How big a shift in mentality is this going to require, though? Not so much from citizens who, as you say, seem to be on board with it, but with government. Again, going back to what you were saying about Singapore, as anybody who's been there knows, is make Switzerland look like a hotbed of devil-may-care anarchy. It is an almost manically tidy place.
Yeah, it's interesting because actually the Singaporean the land authority there is pretty switched on, and they're already kind of across this, what you could call a trend in landscape architecture, which has been towards wilding within cities. So if you look at a place like Copenhagen, all of the progressive landscape architecture that's happening in the city actually has a lot to do with just leaving things how they are, or reintroducing original species back into the city, things that should be there. And this obviously just helps things immensely. So the Singaporean government has weirdly kind of been across this. So it's actually now having the public on side means that they can kind of press ahead with these ideas anyway. So for the Singaporeans that had doubts about, you know, having a big grassy field behind their house instead of a perfectly manicured lawn, maybe things will change quite quickly.
So Singapore, do you then think, is confident about embracing an untidier future?
Strangely enough, Andrew, I think it is. And if you look at some of the gardens that they have created there, there's a place called Jurong Lake Gardens. They've introduced swamps into this land, grasslands. They've created, landscape architecture that mimics the actual the tides of the ocean around it. Everything is already becoming a little bit messier and a little bit more free for the birds and butterflies to come back. And I know you follow these types of stories quite closely, Andrew, but I'm wondering if you're aware of the otters which have come back to Singapore.
I am not aware of the otters. I'm always here for otters. Talk to us about otters for about 20 to 25 seconds.
Okay, well, Singapore you know, has a lot of waterways, and once upon a time there was many otters in the waterways. Now, not so many otters, but because of all of these efforts from Singapore to reintroduce proper biodiversity back into the natural landscape there and the urban landscape, otters have been, you know, flooding back, and they've been seen in places like Chinatown, that they've been seen around the city. So they're definitely getting about, which kind of shows the progress Singapore's making with greening the place.
Nolan Giles, on that happy note, thank you for joining us. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James, Yolin Goffan and Marcus Hippie. The researcher was Charlie Phil McCourt, and our studio manager today was Sam Impey. The Briefing returns at the same time tomorrow, midday London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.
As coronavirus stretches global healthcare systems, online platforms that offer medical advice remotely are helping to ease the strain on hospitals. Allianz, the world's largest insurer and asset manager, collaborates with firms across the globe to offer a tailored and truly worldwide service. Different markets require different solutions and partners, and in Thailand, Allianz works with local telemedicine firm Chiwi. Here's the firm's founder.
My name is Dr. Piraya Tamrong Terokul. I'm co-founder and CEO of Chiwi Application. So Chiwi Application is a provider for Healthy Living Talk, which is an online platform for matching specialists and patients. We started off with a group of healthcare providers, including doctors, dentists, pharmacists, nurses, who see lack of healthcare accessibility in Thailand.
Chiwi and platforms like it offer swift access to doctors from mobile phones, mitigating the risk of infection and helping people in more remote communities to get the care they need. The service also insulates hospitals from unnecessary visits and offers patients peace of mind and personalized solutions.
So we started off as an online web board where patients can come in and post their questions online, and we as specialists will come in and answer the question. And we found that the one-way communication without interaction is not good enough. So we created an app, a mobile app, where patients and doctors or medical specialists can having interactive conversation.
Allianz is currently working with telemedicine partners in 26 countries, proving that global health solutions can start with the touch of a button. Intrigued? Well, you can hear stories like this here on the show every day, or read more in the Monocle Minute every morning. Or you can find out more anytime about building an Allianz for Life at allianz.com.